There's no point backing up data you don't need. Before you back it up, should you back it up? And then if you're not doing that, you're going to have to get that policy in place, because you don't want to be that next brand in the market where legacy data is being used to hold your company and your customers to ransom.
You're listening to KBCast, the cybersecurity podcast for all executives. Cutting through the jargon and hype to understand the landscape where risk and technology meet. Now, here's your host, Carissa Breen.
Joining me today is Pete Murray, Managing Director ANZ from Veritas, and today we're discussing how CISOs need visibility, understanding, and proper governance of data that's putting them at risk of ransomware attacks. So Pete, thanks for joining. It's wonderful to have you on the show.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So Pete, I really want to start with your statement around CISOs need more visibility. Are you insinuating that CISOs don't really have visibility of their environment?
I am insinuating that, but that's not the fault of the CISO. It's the fault of how we've got to where we are in the way that clients procure end-to-end data security. So a CISO has typically looked at perimeter security, application security, so things like multi-factor authentication and so on. They've looked at making sure that viruses don't get in. They've made sure that ransomware doesn't get in, that they educate people on clicking on malicious emails. So they've looked at what I would typically call the traditional security stack from end to end. Data protection, or the recovery of data, or the encrypted backup of that data, has typically sat in the infrastructure side of the business. So the people who buy compute or buy storage, and then they need to back up that data that's on that storage and have the ability to recover it, has typically sat in the tower of infrastructure. And those don't meet typically until you get to the CIO. So what you've had is you've had an awful lot of people making sure that bad actors don't get in. And you've had another group of people making sure that if the data gets encrypted, that it can be recovered, but not collectively. So what we've found, and we did a survey last year, and we asked CISOs questions like, how much of the data do you know is being protected? Do you know if you could orchestrate a recovery of that data? And loosely speaking, over 50% were only moderately confident or worse. And that's not because it may not be true. It's because they didn't know the answer to that question. So what we would suggest is that a CISO now needs to perhaps flip to a more horizontal perspective of security versus a tower perspective of security, and start looking at how they can orchestrate recovery, not just how they can manage the defense.
So can you describe what a horizontal perspective means for people who are perhaps unfamiliar with that term?
What I mean by that is that a CISO should be looking across everything, not just that traditional security stack. So the firewall and the malware protection and the virus scanning and all of the stuff that sits inside the tower that is security, turn that perspective on its side and start looking down. Well, how am I securing my cloud? How am I securing my data from a recovery perspective? Because the bad actor is going to get in. You know, recent media would suggest bad actors are going to get in, and you then need to be in a position to know that you can recover, because a CISO is about information security, not just perimeter and access security. So stop looking through the vertical tower of the stack and start looking across the horizontal deployment of data wherever it sits inside that organization.
Yeah, and that makes total sense from a holistic point of view. So why would you say people historically be looking at more vertically, or that's just sort of how it was historically, and then, you know, bad habits or, you know, the way of how you see things sort of hangs around?
Yeah, I wouldn't even suggest that it's a bad habit. It's just the way that the industry has evolved. One of the things that upsets me about my part of data protection is that we were seen as an insurance policy. Now, everybody spent all of their money making sure people couldn't get in and that they could detect things that were coming in to the organization. And then there was this insurance policy called data protection. Whereas I think what is now happening is that the CISOs are realizing that the bad actor will get in, or let's assume That would be my number one guidance to any CISO. Assume that they will get in. So therefore, what do you do around recovery? So if you were to look at the Essential Eight from the ACSC, the eighth part of the Essential Eight is have a backup. Okay, that's fascinating. But the ninth part of the Essential Eight that's missing is make sure that you can actually recover it. Because a backup that you can't recover at the right time to the right data point was a bad insurance policy. The parallel would be your house burns down because of a lightning strike, and then there was a caveat in your insurance policy that says we exclude forces of nature.
Wow, yeah, absolutely. So is that sort of what's happening at the moment, that people don't have the backups for the recovery side of things, or?
No, I think generally speaking, across my industry, the vast majority of customers would have a backup of at least their on-premise, at least. So they would have a backup of their on-premise data, and they would probably be of the belief that if that data, their production data got encrypted, that they'd be able to recover that data. That's what they would hope that a provider like Veritas or any other provider would be able to do for them. However, one would suggest that that's not always true. And the reason that I would stipulate that is that if everybody could recover their data when it was encrypted in the right time frame, people wouldn't be paying ransoms at all because the backup would be working. But on the basis that people are paying ransom to get their data de-encrypted, it would have to suggest that the backups aren't always doing their job. That's why I point to the statistic about the ability to orchestrate the recovery. Don't have a insurance policy for your house unless you've also got smoke detectors in the house, because otherwise the house is just going to burn down. And then how long is it going to take you to rebuild the house versus the smoke detector goes off and you know that the house is burning down. It only damages a small part of it. Let's get that part back into action. And that's the bit that I think is missing. It's not that they don't have backup software or a backup platform. It's that they haven't tested it. They don't know how to orchestrate it in the right time frame to get the data back. So the path of least resistance is pay the bad actor, their Bitcoin, and get a key that you hope works.
So when you said before, Pete, get the data back. So when you say people haven't really practiced that, why is that the case? Is it time poor, don't want to think about it, don't know even how to think about it? Why is that?
I would suggest that there's two reasons that people aren't necessarily orchestrating or getting ready to orchestrate a recovery. The first would be that there's been this insurance policy attitude towards data backup. I literally was at a session about cybersecurity yesterday where I was on a panel and I was called the last line of defense. The other people on the panel were all what I would call traditional security providers, and I was the last line of defense. Well, gee, if that's how I'm being described, which I love, by the way, if that's how we're being described and you aren't testing my ability to defend you as the last line of defense, then what's the point of having me at all? If I'm just there taking a backup of data and you haven't worked out that you can get it back, why take the backup in the first place?
So who were the other people on the panel? What was their sort of roles and what were they doing if you were the last line of defense?
So they were seen providers, so the people looking at the security environment and watching for anomalies. They were firewall, malware, virus scanning people. They were, one of them was a cloud provider. So one of them was a network provider and securing network access and network control. So they were all in that stack, that vertical stack that I talked about, which typically does not include backup and recovery. And there was me sitting there as the last, by their words, not mine, the last line of defense. It would be like going to war and not checking that what you're taking as the last line of defense could defend against the enemy.
So what happens if your line of defense doesn't work? What happens then?
Well, the first thing I would say is that in our over 30 years of history, we've never not been able to recover clients' data, ever. So we're very good at it. But if that fails, then you're going to be paying the bad actor as option A, or option B, you're rebuilding from scratch.
So none of those are great options, but if you had to pick one, which one would you pick? We had to lean towards one.
The answer is to make sure that you've got a backup platform that can do two things. They've got to do a lot of other things, but two critical things. Firstly, make sure that 100% of that backup environment is what we call in the industry immutable. Not just the data, but the application itself. Make sure that the application is as secure as the data that it is securing. That's the first one. The second one is work out what is called your recovery time objective and your recovery point objective. Those things mean how much data am I going to need to recover from what time period and how quickly do I need to be able to recover it? So if your platform is scaled to do the backup, but it can't dynamically scale to do the recovery is going to be at the speed of the backup, which sometimes might be too slow. The bigger the organization that gets, the quicker that recovery time needs to be.
Well, that was just going to be my next question. What would you say, Pete, in your experience, would be reasonable recovery time? And I guess it depends on the size of the organization, but if you could just give me like a barometer of a large enterprise, what should that recovery time be?
Before they start business the next day, because that's when they start losing real money and that's when they start suffering real brand damage. So the backup, unless you're a 24/7 operation like a utility or a telco or a hospital perhaps, but if you're a typical Australian business and you run from, let's say 7:30 in the morning when your first employee turns up till, let's say 8:30, 9 o'clock at night when your last person logs out and goes home because they've been working late, you will kick your backup at just after midnight, let's say, and you will complete that backup by, let's say, 5 in the morning. Well, if you needed to recover that data, you cannot not recover it inside that same time period, because otherwise when your customers start turning up and your people start turning up to work the next day, they're not going to have access to the second most critical asset that any organization has, which is their data. So if you haven't practiced, so this is a vicious circle almost. If you haven't practiced orchestrating, knowing that you can recover the critical things that keep your business running by the next morning, you're going to have brand damage. And we've seen that in the press. You're going to have monumental brand damage. You're going to lose revenue because you can't take an order. You can't generate an invoice. You can't ship some stock. You can't whatever it is that your business does. So if you're not ready to go when the first person walks through the door, your business has stopped.
Most definitely. That's why this is important for executives to understand, like every day that you're not operating, the brand damage, like you mentioned, as well as the actual day-to-day activity of staff not doing anything. And then of course, just losing money day-to-day on top of that.
Well, it's now become even more complicated. So the government's just changed the act when it comes to reporting cyber breaches. So previously, it wasn't a voluntary thing, but it wasn't as well as enforced as it possibly could be. And the fine was trivial. It was a trivial fine. So when Optus had to report its breach, that was pre the change in the law. And the fine was a token gesture that Optus could have paid in a heartbeat. Now it's $50 million or 30% of your turnover. That, and you must report it if your organization turns over more than $3 million in revenue. So we're picking up way more organizations into that legal framework. So when Latitude was breached, they've been breached inside that new legal construct. I'm not suggesting what the government is doing about that, but they've been breached inside that new legal construct. And any organization that suffers a breach will suffer three problems. The first problem is that they'll lose money, like what we've just been talking about. If they can't transact, they will lose money. The second thing that will happen is that they'll suffer brand damage. When Medibank got hacked, $1.8 billion got wiped off their market cap. $1.8 billion that they then had to set about recovering. And then the third one is the associated brand damage with that. So they might be able to recover their market cap, but are they going to attract and retain as many customers who may or may not have ongoing confidence in an organization, having now suffered that degree of brand damage in the market?
Absolutely. And I mean, if you go to like, I don't know, news.com and you go in the comments, just see what people say, gives you a pretty good indicator to see where people's heads are at in terms of trust, brand damage, all those types of things, especially for these companies that have been around a long time, right? Like that's hard to recover from because they have been around such a long period of time. And then, of course, they're just going to go to another provider. And I think that's the real worrying part long term. How are you going to get those customers back?
Yeah. So if we were to complete that circle, therefore, it's not just a good thing to make sure they can't get in, because recent activity would suggest that that fails. An equally good thing to do is to make sure that you can get going again in the right time frame to ensure that you minimize the impact. And that's why I'm saying that CISOs need to look at not just stopping anything getting into their organization that they don't want to happen. They need to make sure that when that does, that equally the information security can be recovered.
So there's a statement that goes around, which you've probably heard in the space, like you can't protect what you can't see, which makes sense and probably dovetails nicely into what we've been sort of speaking about already in the interview. Would you say that sort of confirms your original sort of statement around CISOs needing more visibility of their environment?
Yes, but a slightly different lens on the same problem. So, and there's two types of information that we need to be concerned about here. The first type, which is the easiest, should be the easiest to protect, is structured data. Structured data is the type of data that's sitting inside a database behind an application where you have to log into it. And most organizations are astute enough to have multi-factor authentication. So a password and maybe a face ID on your phone or an authentication app on your phone. So they'll have multiple layers of authentication to ensure that only the person that should be accessing that application accesses that application, structured data. And the problem there is someone gets that data. So either it's a malicious intent type activity or someone has socially engineered or obtained that data and has used that to get unauthorized access to that structured data platform. And that's what we saw, for example, with Medibank. No backup platform would have ever saved Medibank because it wasn't that activity. It was a bad actor emulating their ability to get access into Medibank and exfiltrating or stealing that data out of Medibank. The actual data was left unencrypted. The other world, which is the world that typically gets looked a little bit late, is unstructured data. And there's two types of unstructured data. The one that you're most common is email. So people receive all sorts of information and send all sorts of information on email. So for example, when COVID happened, chances are a lot of people emailed their COVID certificate to their employer so that they could get access back into the office. Well, that COVID vaccination certificate has almost the same amount of information on it as a passport. So take the passport number away and replace it with your Medicare number, even worse, your individual healthcare identification number. And they're all sitting in email somewhere. What is sitting in email? You know, photographs of driver's licenses, scanned images of credit cards, resumes with people's home addresses, their dates of birth, phone numbers, middle name, you know, all there's so much stuff sitting in email. Do we know what it is and are we protecting it? That's one world. And the other one is that someone saved the attachment. So they received your COVID certificate and they've saved it on the secure HR drive. Now, in that world, you end up with two problems. The first problem is, what is it and where is it? And there are tools and capabilities to map and classify data, but it's typically limited to age and size and metadata type activities. Very hard to go, is that PDF scanned passport? Is that PDF a New South Wales or a Victorian or a Queensland driver's license? So understanding what your data is and where it is the first challenge to overcome. So that's a visibility challenge. The next one, which definitely gets overlooked, is who has access to all of that unstructured data? So who can see the data that I've saved on different drives? And should they be able to see the data on those drives? Yes or no? And what typically happens is that employee A moves from job A to job B. Has that access been disabled? So that's the second one. And then the absolute perfect one is, if I access 10 files a day and I write 20 files a day, I've got this usage profile of my work. When that changes, does the CISO know about it? So when someone starts downloading terabytes and terabytes of data, do they know that it's happening? And in the new world of people working from home and, you know, the follow on from the pandemic of trying to get people back into work, that's becoming an even bigger problem.
So there's a couple of things in there you said before. Where is it? I mean, I've spoken to people at length on this show. A lot of people can't answer that. They don't know is typically the response because, like you said, you know, people working from anywhere, people leveraging cloud. We don't really actually know where, you know, all that data is being stored, who's accessing it. So what would be sort of your recommendation? I mean, obviously at more of a higher level for people that are unsure, like how to start asking the right questions and then getting those answers from people.
Yeah. So it's actually a fairly complicated problem to solve. So I would urge a CISO to get a tool that can map that dataverse. So they can start seeing where all of the data is. So that's the first point. Where is it? What drives are it on? What servers is it on? What clouds is it sitting on? Where is it all? Because then you could back it up. So that's the first thing you could do. If you didn't need it, you could delete it. So at least you know where it is. So you can then go, what do I want to do about that data? Even better would be, well, what is it? Is it financial data in an Excel spreadsheet? Is it letters of application for a job? Is it images of COVID vaccination certificates? So what is it and where is it would be an even better step. And then go about protecting the stuff that actually matters. Delete the stuff you don't want. You know, COVID vaccination certificates, delete them all. Don't need them anymore. Why aren't they being deleted? Because people don't know where they are. And then the third one, if you can, if you get the right tool, who has access to it and should they have access to it? But you can't do it through asking your team because they won't know. You've got to get a tool to do it.
I was just about to ask that because people probably, yeah, they won't know. And also, if someone leaves the company and someone was responsible for those COVID vaccinations, they've left. Like, how are you going to get, you know, ascertain that information from someone if you're relying on just asking people?
Yeah, well, take resumes. So when I applied for my job at Veritas, I sent them my resume. I sent them lots of things that I sent them. Passport details to prove that I actually am an Australian because I'm a New Zealander really, but I really am an Australian. I sent them all sorts of data. So, and let's assume that Veritas is keeping it safe because that's our job, right? So we're in the industry. Let's assume our data's been kept safe. If I was ever to leave, shouldn't all of that data be deleted? Because it's actually my data, not Veritas's data. So if I was to leave Veritas, shouldn't it be deleted? And there are amendments to the Privacy Act with the government now. Clearly, we don't know what they are. But if we were to follow the guidance from overseas countries, one would suggest that one of the things that might come in is the right of the customer to be forgotten by the entity that got their personal identifiable information. Can you please tell me, Company B, do you have any of my personal information in your data network? Yes or no? Firstly, you have to be able to answer that question. And then if they go, I'd like you to delete that, other than things you might be required to keep under statute or under law, you're going to have to be able to delete it. That's going to be another head spin should that law come in.
Most definitely. This is the challenge that people have with Optus, for example. So it's like, okay, you've authenticated that I'm the customer. Like, why do you need to continuously store it? But then other people had different versions of it to say, well, if they don't pay their bill, Carissa, and we have to get a debt agency onto you, for example, we need to know who you are. And those are the reasons for storing it. But I guess that would depend then on companies as to why they need to retain that information up until if you were to leave Veritas, for example. Do you think that people haven't really thought it through in terms of the complexity as to why they need to store it ongoing versus, hey, we've authenticated X person, we don't need to store it anymore?
Yes, there's a certain element to that. But a lot of organizations are heavily regulated around retaining data. So if you're a financial services organization, you're governed by APRA. And APRA have a whole bunch of policies that say, this is what you must and must not comply with. So in that world, for example, a bank has to keep stuff for 7 years by law. So they're going to have to keep all of the stuff about you for 7 years because that's the law. But once the 7 years is up, they don't need to keep it. Telcos, for example, also have similar regulations, different governing body, but they have similar regulations about needing to keep data. But eventually, they don't need to do that. Latitude had data going back 15 years.
So on the regulation piece, totally understand that. I mean, I worked for a bank for a few years and I get that, but then it's more, okay, so the 7 years comes up. How confident are you that people are going, okay, well, now we've got to delete Carissa Breen's data? Or do you think that it just goes by the wayside. And I ask this because I know for a fact, look at Medibank, they didn't do that, neither did Optus, because there is people writing to me saying, hey, I haven't been an Optus customer for 10 years. Like, why am I being held up in this breach?
A good organization is doing it for two reasons. One, it's a good idea to get rid of it. Two, you're paying an awful lot of money to store stuff you don't need. And if you're a backup client of Veritas, you're backing up all of that data and paying money for that privilege as well that you didn't need, which is why I said start with knowing your data. There's no point backing up data you don't need. It's lovely because we make a lot of money doing that. But I would tell any client of Veritas, any client of any of my competitors, before you back it up, should you back it up? And then if you're not doing that, you're going to have to get that policy in place, because you don't want to be that next brand in the market where legacy data is being used to hold your company and your customers to ransom.
Would you say it's quite a high percentage of customers out there that are just storing data that they don't need?
Yes.
Is it due to them not having the right policies and processes, or is it just them to thinking like, oh, well, you know, we've got other things to worry about. That's the least of our worries, and thinking about storing data unnecessarily.
I think my industry hasn't helped. So Moore's law would suggest everything gets twice as good for half the price. So what's happened over time is that the cost of storing something has dropped dramatically. And when Veritas backed something up, we duplicate that data and we put it on the cheapest storage available, unless you need it on a faster storage platform to meet that recovery time thing that we talked about earlier. We put the backup on the lowest cost storage possible. So if we're backing up Azure in Microsoft's cloud, we'll take the initial backup and then we'll put it straight into Blob, which is super cheap storage. So maybe because it's so cheap, let's not worry about understanding what we're backing up. Let's just back it all up, because that's a safe path. It's a safe path to ensure we're backing up everything. But some of it should just be deleted. There's a great saying in our industry called ROT, all in capitals, redundant, obsolete, and trivial. If you don't know where that is, all you're doing is backing it up. And by definition, you didn't need it, because it was either redundant, obsolete, or trivial data. Just delete it and back up what you should be backing up.
Yeah, okay. So that's definitely an interesting observation. So basically what you're saying, Pete, is because it's cheap to do, Pete, it's not like causing that much attention, like maybe on a P&L perspective, but there are other security vendors out there that charge a lot for this stuff. So maybe they're getting questioned more because like, wow, like, you know, all these logs are costing us so much money a month. Like, what do we need it for? But you're sort of saying maybe people are backing up things unnecessarily because it is so cheap, so it doesn't really get flagged as much, potentially.
Potentially, absolutely potentially, especially in that unstructured world. Typically in a structured database, like that application conversation that we had a while back, in a structured database, maybe not so much, but in unstructured data, I mean, you'd only need to open your Explorer, assuming you're running on a Windows device, but you only need to open up the folders that you have on your personal device, do a view by date created, but backwards, and see how old your oldest file is, and then go, gee whiz, do I need that? And then look at how many copies of the same file that you have. Well, do I need all of them? Why do I need multiple copies of the financial statements that we exported out of SAP into Excel so that we could do some fancy graphing? Well, how many copies of the same report exist? Surely you only need one of it. Everybody still needs to have access to that one file that should have access to that one file, but that's not what happens. The Excel file gets emailed to everybody. You save it on your drive because you don't want to run off OneDrive because it's a bit slow, because your internet connection's a bit flaky, because your child's competing with it doing TikTok. So you save it onto your local laptop. Who knew that? Which is why I would suggest backing up data is really easy. It really is. It's not hard to do. Knowing what you're backing up and then being able to ensure you can recover what you've backed up, that's not so easy. That's complicated.
How you're saying and what you're saying makes total sense, right? Like logically, yes, you're right. But then it's like in an ideal world thing, you know, stuff starts happening. Security, you know, you're looking at incidents you've got to respond on, or there's all these alerts that you've got to do, or you've got all these board meetings. So it's like this problem becomes sort of lower down the chain because you've got other conflicting priority. Now, it's still important. It just may not be a high priority. So how would you sort of approach trying to balance this out? Because everything you mentioned before around, oh, you know, the kid on TikTok, so I'm just going to save it, you know, locally, makes sense, right? I get that. But then how do you sort of bring that to the forefront? Because people got other things that they're worrying about as well. So this technically, according to people or businesses, is a lower priority.
Understand. So because you're never going to be able to stop human behavior, because at the end of the day, the weakest link in any security posture is human behavior. So you're not going to be able to change people's human behavior. And we've actually gone to the extent of enabling all of our people to be able to work from anywhere thanks to the pandemic. So therefore, you need to make sure that you've got the right tools and processes in place to manage that new data sprawled environment, which is not terribly hard to do, and then integrate it into your scene. So the platform that's monitoring all of the other security things that are going on, make sure that a green light goes red when someone starts accessing files that they shouldn't. Make sure that a green light goes red when someone starts reading or writing more data than they should. And you'll pick up an awful lot of that rogue behavior. And then you can do something about it as the CISO.
What would then be sort of your advice for CISOs that are listening to this interview, Pete? Like, where can they sort of start? Or, you know, you mentioned before around, you know, looking holistically rather than vertically. Like, is there any sort of advice you'd like to leave our audience with today?
Yeah, I would say the most important thing to do is to understand where your data is, what it is, and who has access to it. That's the most critical thing, because then you can work out, should it be there? Should they have access to it? And what am I going to do to protect it? Because if you don't know that, you don't know what you're protecting, which goes back to, if you can't see it, you can't do anything about it. Understand that dataverse through those three lenses. What is it? Where is it? And who has access to it? Once you know that, you can then set about securing access to it, removing it if you didn't want to have it there, backing it up because it's critical data. You can then set about protecting that data landscape properly.
I love that. Short, sharp, and simple. So really appreciate your time today, Pete, for sharing some of your thoughts and your insights, and also, you know, giving practical advice to people and getting people to start asking those questions internally. So thanks so much for taking the time out today to come on the show. Really appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope that you found today's episode useful and you took away a few key points. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get our latest episodes.
This podcast is brought to you by MercSec, the specialists in security, search, and recruitment solutions. Visit MercSec.com to connect today.
If you'd like to find out how KBI can help grow your cyber business, then please head over to KBI.digital.
This podcast was brought to you by KBI.media, the voice of cyber.